I just think that the content of these promise oracles is just, amazing when you think about what is God really promising his renegade creation, his rebels. It's pretty amazing. And just, I would urge you to read the prophets and to just spend time in reflection and meditation on these extraordinary descriptions of salvation that has both come and that is coming for us as God's people. Now, on the next page of your outline, then, we want to talk about oracle structure. We've been talking about the kinds of oracles that we find. We spent a great deal of time on these because I think it's just really important that you get a deep grasp of what these things are about. But now we want to move right into the particular oracles themselves. Just as we talked about narrative books and massive swaths of narrative history, that was important, but ultimately we had to move down in our analysis right into the particular narrative and break it down into scenes and so forth. Well, the same thing is true of our oracles. And so in an oracle, I just want to make the point that we are going to be making through each of these genres that we investigate, and which is that there is really mostly, most of the time, I think, it would be fair to say, there is a main point, a central point that the prophet is making, and then that central point is supported or illustrated or applied in various ways in the oracle itself. And so our task as interpreters is to kind of break down the logic, how the ideas within an oracle relate to one another, and specifically in relation to a main point and how that main point is supported. So to identify structure within an oracle, a particular one, there are some, tips, I guess, suggestions, things to look for that that if you are closely looking at will be helpful to you in terms of getting at what is the main point and how is it supported. And the first would be to note points of repetition. And again, we've said this quite a few times, really, but it bears repeating that repetition is one of the most important techniques that biblical writers, Hebrew writers, use to fix the reader's attention on what matters, what's important, what's significant here. And so we see that the prophets also use the technique of repetition. I'll look at an example of that here in just a few minutes. Repetition of key words or key phrases. What would be a key phrase, for instance, that is we've already talked about? The day of the Lord. Exactly. Yeah, that kind of thing. And that kind of gets at, what is the main point of this thing and how does it all fit together. Secondly would be, we want to look at links. Remember we talked about markers and links. Markers are these key promises, blessings, covenants that God enters into with humanity in the narrative portions of the Old Testament. In the prophets, those things are cited, they're referred to. And when one of those markers is referred to, we call it a link because it's linking together this particular text with the earlier text. And when we see linking passages, allusions to or quotes from Old Testament that bring the importance of the idea in its narrative context into a fresh situation, that is an important indication of the main point, but sometimes it's a supporting point. But nonetheless, we want to be aware of that because it's going to fit prominently into the structure. Thirdly, there's a declaration of God's verdict, especially in these denunciation oracles, a declaration of God's intent, God's plan, which could be often used in a blessing or a promise oracle, and where the details provide kind of the supporting point for the verdict God reaches or the declaration God makes. But when God speaks, and he speaks with this kind of finality, Well, that's the main point of the oracle, and everything else kind of fits within that framework. Connective language. We're going to definitely see this. We're going to spend a whole week on this, basically, when we come to the New Testament epistles. But connective language is important. There are words that relate ideas to each other in a text. And main point connective words, you know, when we see the word therefore, as we've all been taught, when you see the word therefore, you ask yourself, okay, see, there you go. So therefore, therefore. And it's there for the purpose of bringing you as a reader to the awareness that an inference is being drawn, a conclusion is being drawn. And that conclusion that's being drawn is very commonly the main point of the oracle. So words like therefore, thus, so, sometimes, as a result, consequently, and there's others as well, indicate, you know, that the prophet is drawing a conclusion in his oracle, and that it's supported by ideas often introduced with language like because, or for, or but, or since, or indeed. These are words that are giving reasons for, they're introducing reasons for why something is true. We should really open the doors in this room for, it's very hot in here. See, the word for being used that way to introduce the reason why something is true. It's a supporting point. Follow me? It's so simple, it just isn't worth repeating, I guess. Okay. Concluding statements or summary statements that are made by the prophet, those are, I think, really important. When the author, when the prophet interjects himself personally into the text, that's really significant, because he's saying, here's what God is going to do, this is what it's all about, and therefore, you know, this is what it looks like to respond to that. And so oracles that include the prophet's own insertion or involvement in the thing, really important. Imperatives are very much like this. A command to act would be the main point of an oracle where imperatives are there. Like the call to repent, the call to believe, things like that. That's crucial, because at the end of the day, all of the denunciations and words of judgment, for instance, are there for a reason, for a purpose. And what is the purpose? So that God's people would repent. And all of this description of gloom and doom and judgment goes away, right? So those would be some examples. I think those are kind of the central devices that biblical prophets use to orient their reader to what the main point of their oracle is. And what I've done, and we're not going to read through this whole thing, but I did want to show you from Micah, since you've read Micah, how we can look at these oracles and come to a place where we are able to kind of ferret out what is the main point of the thing. So, for instance, then, in Micah, well, I'm in chapter 4? Okay. Micah 4, 1-5, is a promise oracle. And notice how it begins. And it will come about. And when will it come about? Okay, so what kind of, what strand of the hair is this? Come on. This is the day of the Lord. Exactly. Okay, so we're automatically plugged into this kind of promise idea that the mountain of the house of the Lord. Remember what the mountain kind of represents in ancient Near Eastern imagery? It's the place of God's residence. The mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief mountain. It will rise above the hills. The people will stream to it. Again, odd. Many nations will come. What does that represent? Many nations will come. The completion of the Abrahamic promise. And they'll say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, that we may walk in his paths, for from Zion will go forth a law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he will judge between many peoples and render decisions for mighty distant nations. Then, he says, they will hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not lift up sword against nation, never again will they train for war. That is almost dead identical to Isaiah 2, verse 4. Remember, Micah and Isaiah were contemporaries. This is kind of a little bit of a window into plagiarism in the Bible. I'm not saying who's told from who, but it's significant that exact same verbiage is being used. It's really helpful, I think, in terms of just instilling once again that here is this group of people. They're interacting with each other. They speak with one voice to God's people at a point in time. Anyway, so it goes on and explains this really sweet day of the Lord. But concludes, he says, though all the peoples walk each according to the name of his God, as for us, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. And so there's just this concluding comment, right, where Micah is just interjecting himself. Because this is what's going to happen. Here's what it looks like. Here's what we do. As for us, we will walk in the name of the Lord forever. That is a statement of purpose. It's a concluding statement based upon the promises in that day or in the day of the Lord. You see how that works? Okay, so that's an example of a kind of concluding statement orienting us to the main point. What about the oracle in verses 6 to 8 in chapter 4? Since it's shorter, it'd be easier for us to get. In that day. Oh man, we're really getting accustomed to seeing this language. In that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame, I will gather the outcast. Even those whom I have afflicted, I will make the lame a remnant, and the outcast a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on and forever. As for you, tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you it will come, even the former dominion will come, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. Interesting. It's hard to see exactly what is the point of that oracle, the main point, because it's just sort of a snapshot description of the day of the Lord, right? But notice how it's constructed. I will bring together the lame. I will make the lame a remnant. The Lord will reign. The former dominion of Jerusalem will come. The former dominion will come. There's a repetition of a formula here. What God will do. See, it's just repeated how many times? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 times in 2 verses. And again, so this is that principle that we use an expression repeatedly in this way, because it conveys something really important, that the blessings that come in this oracle, we can be assured of. Why? Why can we be assured of them? Because God said, the I am said, I will. That's how. See? And so just by again, looking at these structural techniques, these structural clues, it helps us to see with a clarity that we wouldn't see without that. That this is really what the author is emphasizing here. It's that this is all the work of God. This is what He will do. Does that make sense? In denunciation of chapter 6, verses 1 to 5, the Lord has a case to make against His people. It's that whole courtroom metaphor that we have talked about before. And then just super interestingly, in verses 3 to 5, God speaks and just introduces the evidence against His people. Exhibit A, I ransomed you from Egypt, the house of slavery. Exhibit B, I led you through the wilderness with Moses and Aaron. Exhibit C, I provided you guidance in Balak and Balaam so that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. So that's God's, the substance of God's case. And that's what this thing is about. And so he's given a summary statement. The Lord has a case, and then he's describing what that case is. So it's the device of summary statement that gets us to what the main point is there. In verses 6 to 8, here again in chapter 6, it begins with, "What shall I come to the Lord?" That's a question, isn't it? And how is that question answered? Well, God has told man what is good and what God requires. So he answers his own question, right? And what is his answer? What does God require, he says in verse 8? Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. So those are imperatives. He starts with a question and he just gives an answer. Boom, right there. In chapter 6, verses 9 to 16, an oracle of judgment. The voice of the Lord calls to the city, "Hear, O tribe, who has appointed its time?" And then he talks about the coming judgment of God based on the fact that of the unjust measures and weights. So that's economic injustice, the lies and the deceit of the rich. And he draws a conclusion from that, so I will strike you down, making you sick. And then he describes what that striking down and making sick is. You'll be hungry. You'll live alongside of your own waste. That's your sewage. You'll save nothing. Your agriculture will fail. And then he indicts him again, you know, because you walked in the way of Omri. He's a bad player. And then he just says, therefore I give you up to destruction. Well, what's the therefore? It's there for the purpose of drawing a conclusion based upon the evidence of the text. That's what's going to happen. I'll give you up to destruction, and the oracle explains why. In chapter 7, 1 to 6, and again another denunciation, oracle, and which just begins, "Woe is me." It's a lament. And then specific reasons are given for why he is in woe and why he must lament. Nothing's left to glean. The godly have perished. Only evil people remain. Princes and judges ask for bribes. The best of them are like a briar thorn. Don't trust your neighbor or your friend. Your sons tread on their fathers with contempt. Daughters rise up against mothers. A man's enemies are his own house. You know, it's bad news. But there's a reason given for what? For the woe, which is the main point of the thing. And then the whole prophecy of Micah just comes together in such a beautiful way in verse 7 through 20, where he makes this pronouncement, "As for me," you know, in contrast with the woes that he has just been describing, "As for me, I will watch for the Lord, wait for my salvation, my God will hear me." And then three specific reasons are provided for why is he watching, or what does it look like to watch. And the first is in verses 8 to 13, "Do not rejoice over me, my enemy." Because why? "Because though I am in darkness, the Lord is my light. And I will bear his indignation because I'm guilty after all." And until he pleads my case and executes my justice, he'll wait to bring me to the light, and I'll see his righteousness at some point. "My enemy will see and will be ashamed of the taunt, 'Where is your God?' The walls will be built and its boundary extended. The nations will come to us." And so those are reasons given for why Micah's enemies who are taunting him should not rejoice over him. And then secondly, the call to God as a shepherd of his flock, a real familiar kind of description of God as the shepherd of his people. So he says, the flock is your possession. As in the days long past when you came out of Egypt. And I will show you miracles. And the nations will see and be ashamed of their deeds. And then lastly, and then he just ends with this crescendo. Who is like God? Who is like Yahweh? Pardoning iniquity, passing over the rebellion of his possession, whose anger does not last forever because he delights in unchanging love. And he will again have compassion on us, casting away our sins to the depths of the sea. And he who gives truth to Jacob, unchanging love to Abraham, which you swore to our forefathers in the days of old. So that's just some, you know, that's how you just break down the structure, and you just look for those cues. And in my experience, I think that this can be difficult. It's not a common exercise that people do, and can be a little frustrating. And so just what I'm suggesting that you do is just work at it and try it. And remember, we talked in the first week about the cool thing about inductive logic is that you can check your work. And one of the key criteria for inductive proof is adequacy, and which is to say, if I've chosen a particular verse or term or something like that as the main point of the oracle, I can ask myself the question, does the whole oracle fit together in relation to that main point? How does it fit together coherently in the light of that main point? And if we can explain all of the parts in relation to that suggestion of a main point, then it passes this test of adequacy. We've done a good job. It's likely that we've understood the structure of the text. And so we just continue, we just do that, we interact, and pretty soon, again, going back to the learning music thing, you know, where maybe at first you're looking at the sheet of music and you're dink, 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 you know, like this. Pretty soon you just forget where your fingers are. You just know where they are in relation to what's guiding you is the notes on the page. And that, you know, there's a transition that just happens. Interpretation is an art. And as you practice it and as you kind of allow yourself the grace to stumble around, and especially as you share your considerable ignorance with your friends and talk about it with them, it sharpens the picture and you begin to see more clearly. And there's something that's kind of sweet that begins to happen. And what is sweet is that you begin to realize, I get it. I understand the thought progression of this oracle. And I understand, too, what kind of oracle it is. And I understand the significance of the kind of oracle it is. Now we're really cooking with gas. Now we've got some stuff that is really drilling us deep into an understanding of the thought of God, the mind of God. Sweet. Now, let's move to, we've talked about structure. And we'll talk more about structure next week when I review your assignments. Now let's talk a little bit about content, muscle, what gives it its shape, its form. And just as we did with historic narratives, the prophets, again, they're orienting themselves out of history. And so as we're reading through an oracle, we want to be mindful of its historical and cultural orientation. And so to the extent that there are things referred to, people, practices, objects, that may bear on interpretation of the text, we'd want to note these things. Things that maybe we're reading, we're like, what is that? Like when you're reading through Micah in chapter 6 and verse 16, and it talks about a denunciation of Jerusalem because they have continued in the sin of Omri. What is that? And so, you know, you go back in the narrative of Kings and you realize, man, Omri was a bad player. Omri was a guy that led the whole nation of Israel into the worship of these false gods on these mountains, these high places. Divination, idolatry, that's what he's talking about here. And so just if there's a word that you don't know, you wonder about, get out your dictionary and look it up. Man, if you read through the denunciations in Micah chapter 1, all these cities are being smacked down, right? And they have all these weird names. Well, it's interesting. Maybe your Bible has footnotes. Maybe you have a study Bible. Maybe you have the forethought of actually looking up these words in a Bible dictionary, and you begin to realize Mike is a funny guy. Mike is playing with words. Each of the city names of destruction in these oracles in Micah 1 are descriptions of how God is going to judge Israel. And I'll just leave that to your own study to do, but names matter. This is my point. Names of God matter. Names of people matter. Names of places matter. And the prophets will talk about God's supremacy over a city, and that city over which God is exercising his authority is significant. So like the destruction of Jericho is an important one. Jericho is literally the city of Yairoch, a Canaanite deity. And so to destroy Jericho is essentially to show that God's supremacy over the gods that the Canaanites trusted in. Any place name that has the word Beth, like Bethlehem, you know, things like that, it's the house of. And very often it's the house of some deity. And so when God moves in judgment against that city, there's a significance there because he's not just defeating a physical structure, but he's also exercising his sovereignty and his justice over the spiritual world as well. And Micah chapter 1 really demonstrates this thing, I think, in a real effective way. So note the historical, cultural things. Anything that's not familiar to you, look it up. Just find out what that thing is about. Then secondly, and this is coming again right off your inductive study template, is a look at the language. You want to identify key words, theological words and concepts, and just to recognize that having identified the type of oracle that we're working with, you've been doing that, and its structure, now it's time to explore the rich background of the terms that make up these oracles. What do the words mean? How commonly are the words used by a particular prophet or within the shared vocabulary of the prophets? And so, you know, so there's all this discussion about redemption or God as the Redeemer. What does that mean? You know, look that up because there's something rich in that. A Goel, a Redeemer, is a patriarchal head of a clan, of a family. It's how they liberate those and care for those in their clan who are in bondage to slavery, who've been kidnapped, and whatever it is. And God is Israel's Goel. He is Israel's Redeemer. So terms, key terms, relate to how these promises are being related or blessings or covenants. So identify key words and define them. That's the whole point here, the theological words. And where figurative language exists, as it so often does in the prophets, because they're interpreting dreams, they're having visions, things like that. Where figurative language exists, what are the clues to its meaning? So, usually, the text itself provides a basis for the meaning of these symbolic terms. For instance, the symbolism of Daniel's dreams of the statue with the different metals and the feet of clay. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's interesting. Daniel himself gives us an explanation of what does that mean in Daniel 2. Sometimes an image is given and then applied in such a way that the connection between the symbolic image and the historical event is clear. So, for instance, the potter and the clay in Jeremiah 18, or the visions that Amos describes of the rotting figs and stuff like that in Amos 7 through 8 are just obvious in context that he's describing Israel, and Israel's time has come and gone. It's kind of heavy in that way. But you want to make sure that you understand the nature of figurative language. Then, very importantly, theology, by which I mean here, what is it saying about salvation, God, and the human dilemma? Those are the three things that we want to think about here with theology. So under salvation, we ask, what does the oracle teach about God's program of salvation on the earth? How does the oracle relate to the plan of salvation? How does it describe salvation? And often the description is in the context or in the terms of material abundance or protection by God or some intimate fellowship with God or God's presence or whatever it is. And you want to be able to just kind of identify that and jot that down. This is what salvation means in this passage, or judgment by contrast. Second, and very importantly, what does the oracle say about God? What does it teach about God's nature? Who is God? What is the name of God in the oracle? We talked a couple of weeks ago about the importance of divine names. That's important to note here as well. How is God described, or how is God contrasted with the false gods or with whatever? How is the description of God rooted in Old Testament narrative? Well, I've given you a little example of this. What does it say about God thing? Find Isaiah to be, the height of literary genius. Is that maybe it? Or just somebody who God spoke to in such moving and prosaic ways. I don't know, but what I do know is if you, for instance, read the second half of Isaiah chapters 40 to 66, and you just are asking the question, "What does it say about God?" That's a really fascinating study, and you see all these reflections in that section of Isaiah on the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, the book of Moses, where repeatedly he uses this expression, I am Yahweh, your God, right out of Exodus. And I am Yahweh, the Creator. And so he goes back to the creation narrative in chapter 40, and 42, and 43, and 66, and you begin to see just how important it is that God is creator, not just to get the ball rolling, but in an ongoing way that God continues to be the creator and involves himself, that creation itself is a window into the salvation of God, as we've talked about before, but God as creator, something that you recognize. God as Goel or redeemer is used 26 times in this section of Isaiah's prophecy, and it's related to being redeemed from bondage, specifically to Egypt, but more importantly, also bondage as a spiritual phenomenon, being slaves to our own devices, our own sin. The redemption also of the Gentiles. And then in the blessing oracles in this section, the redemption of the land itself and of Jerusalem. And then this reflection on Yahweh as the Lord of history, who is its sovereign and who is its king and who discloses its future. And I think just that makes an interesting study. It's a part of an inductive process, but it's really... it can be quite edifying, actually, to camp out on this step and just read through maybe several oracles as I'm describing here and just give summary to what is it saying? Who is God? And it really gives you that sense of the vastness and the fact that God is in every corner, in every outpost, in every piece of the Old Testament, God is there. And it's worth reflecting on. It's kind of sweet. Then there is, of course, the last part of theology has to do with human nature. And what does the oracle teach about human nature, the human situation? And to remember in this context that as social reformers, the prophets speak of God's unchanging truth to ever-changing social realities. And so while humans accommodate sin, God does not. And interpreters, you and I, need to describe the human condition in terms of its failures, its sufferings, as well as its values and virtue, and just kind of make summary statements about what does it say about the plan of salvation, summary statements about what does it say about the nature of God, and summary statements what does it say about the human condition. It's pretty straightforward. It's not that hard to do. You just make those observations as you're reading through the verses that make up the oracle. Then, lastly, in terms of content, is this issue of structure. I mean, of unity. And what I want to get at here, again, is just that these oracles are very deliberate attempts to show the singularity of God's purpose in the world. And so these oracles will come to us in a variety of modes of fulfillment. And specifically, we're talking about promise oracles here, although also it will relate to the judgment and blessing oracles as well. But primarily, again, it's about promise oracles. And so there are a couple kinds that I want us to be aware of. And what first we've talked about already is the idea of motif or type, where the future unfolds the past, showing the continuity of salvation through history. And it's covenants being fulfilled, events being fulfilled, people being fulfilled, objects being fulfilled. The idea here is that the present and the future are the same in the plan of God. And so a past event is a paradigm. It's a model of salvation that bleeds on from the narrative context of the Old Testament into the prophets and from the prophets right on into the New Testament. And so we've seen motif in terms of the Exodus, in terms of the wilderness wanderings, the rock, the manna, things like that. The temple is a type. Individuals are types, like David is a type for Messiah, and so forth. And again, we've seen that, and we're going to turn to that in much more detail in the New Testament. But that piece is there. And then there's also this issue of prediction. Not just fulfilling history, but making specific prediction that is to be fulfilled. The prophets will see the future through visions and words from the Lord, but usually the distant future and the near future are described together, and that can be a little bit confusing. The short-term future of Israel is a picture of what the end of history is going to look like, as though near-term events presage the culmination of history. Or, on the other hand, alternatively, the end of history provides the language and images to describe the short-term future, like it does in Joel chapters 1 and 2. Remember, we looked at Joel earlier when we were talking about the day of the Lord. Well, that's really significant. Joel is in that context talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, something that's going to happen in the ancient history of Judah. But he uses this cosmic language of the end of the world to describe that historic event that happened in 586 B.C. See what I'm saying? And so, in prophecies and their fulfillment, the language of the short term and the language of the long term are very much the same. And so, here's an image. I've stolen this from Gordon Fee. I think it's helpful, though. There's a circle, and then there's a circle outside of it. See that? And so, in the circle, you have a description. Say a time of blessing of God's people after the destruction of the of the city and the exile and all that kind of stuff. There's this blessing that God gives to the prophet that there will be a time of resettlement in the land, and I'll restore the fortunes of Israel. And there's language like that, and the land will be redeemed and all this kind of stuff. And then, in a haze right behind that description, is language that cannot really be used to express merely this blessing of resettlement in the land. There's something more going on. The prophet is using language and seeing more than one event, but expressing it in basically the same kind of language. And so the two circles represent a face-on view. But what if we had the privilege, the ability, not to look on it face-on, but laterally? And that's what these rectangles next to it are. The circles look one way, look like one event with some hazy stuff around the back of it, but looked at from the sequence of history, are actually more than one event with significant gaps between them. So for instance, in the day of the Lord, that language that we've been using before and have seen in Joel, the day of the Lord is the prophet's day. It's a day of judgment. But it's also more than that. It's also the day of the Lord is this time of cosmic destruction on Israel's enemies, and also is the presaging of the ultimate accountability and the judgment of all the nations at the end of history. All of those things are working together in Joel, but using the same language. And so we ask, well, how do you know what he's talking about? And the answer is this: that there are semantic clues in the prophecy that help us to understand the break in time. And so if we go back to Joel, which I would like you to do, check this out. There's all this discussion about the day of the Lord. And then, so there's this description. And then he says in verse 28, this is Joel chapter 2, he says, and it will come about after this. After this. What does that mean? Well, that means that there's a clue in the language being used, that there is a sequence. Now he's talking not about this event, but another event. Even though he's using the same apocalyptic imagery of the end times, he's telling us after this comes something else described in the same way. So temporal clues are important. Things said that could not be true of the historical description at hand. So verb tenses matter. So for instance, in Daniel chapter 9, if you look at that prophecy, it's clear we've got two different time frames going on. This is the 70 weeks prophecy. It's familiar to us. That's why I've chosen it as an example. But it shows this multiple reference phenomenon there, where he says in chapter 9, verse 25, he says, you're to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, and it will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Okay? So the rebuilding of the temple. And then it says, then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people
of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come in a flood. Well, there's something incongruous here. Because the verse before speaks of the coming of the Messiah, and then verse 26 speaks of the death of the Messiah after the temple itself has been rebuilt. So there's a change in a time frame given by Daniel in this context. And so it's clear then that this other week is something that comes at a distance after the event that he's just described. Or there would be, finally, content clues that are signals of multiple reference that prophets use. Like descriptions that relate to universal things and eternal things rather than merely blessings of being resettled in the land would be an example of this kind of phenomenon, a sort of double exposure. Years ago, I went to northern Russia, and early in the morning we took this truck. It was like, you know, insano below zero outside, and of course they don't have antifreeze there, and so we're in this Soviet era truck, and we get out to, because we're going to do some ice fishing, and the guy who's taking us out, Leonid, unscrews this valve, and all the water from his radiator flushes out. And I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting. We do our ice fishing and the vodka drinking and all that. And so now it's like, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and it's time to go back. So what does he do? He closes that bolt on his radiator, and then he scoops a bunch of snow into a pan and gets out a torch and melts the snow, pouring it into the radiator so it works. See what I'm saying? I thought that was the weirdest thing that I'd ever seen. So I'm out there, I'm taking pictures of it. And I'm like, click, you know, and then I'm like, oh man, I'm out of film. So quickly I throw this thing out, and I grab another roll of film, and I put it in, and like this. Back in the olden days, we used to have to do that. And then I'm taking more pictures, only to get home and realize I took out a roll of film, turned around, and put exactly that same roll of film back in. And my pictures were all double exposed. And so I've got this event, namely the fish-eating party at Leonid and Olga's house, and the melting of snow out on the frozen lake all together there, double exposed. Well, prophecy works by the principle of double exposure. And that's how double reference works. And so you look at the prophecy and you say, what is it that makes sense in the light of something like the resettlement of Israel in the land? And what is it in this thing that is way more than that, that deals with the nations, that deals with God's eternal rule, that things like that? And that is the way to kind of separate these two things that are being described within the same prophecy. You just look at the language that's being used and realize we're talking about two different things. It's not science. It's not that complicated, really. It's just, this is how the prophets put their thing out there to us. And if we just begin to realize those things, we look at temporal clues and we realize we're talking about two different time frames. We look at linguistic clues and or semantic clues, and we realize they're using terms like there's this thing and then there's that thing. That's a clue. We look at those things and we begin to realize I can go like this and see these two things together, and then I can go to the side and see that they are really talking about different events in salvation history. So next week we'll take a look at a couple examples of those. But I want to get through this description first, and then we'll break for the night. Double reference, also direct prediction. Actually, this happens a little bit less than the other forms of prophecy, but where it exists, it's the most interesting. So here you've got a specific event or person that has a singular fulfillment. the anticipated Davidic king, King Messiah. There are not many messiahs. There is a Messiah. In Isaiah 52, as we'll see next week, in 53, the enigmatic anonymous servant. There's a description and a prediction of this person and that leads to an understanding of its fulfillment. In Daniel 2, 7, and 8, you have the emergence of specific nations. That this metal reflects that nation and so forth. So you've got a prediction and its fulfillment in history. In Micah 5, 2, the text that you read for your assignment, you have the where is the ruler going to come from? He's going to come from Bethlehem, from David's place. And so, of course, you know, when the Magi show up to Herod's court and say, so where's the king? What do the scribes that Herod assembles say? Well, they say Micah 5, 2, it's going to be in Bethlehem. That's where. And so that's an example of direct prediction and its singular fulfillment. Then lastly, and I think it's an important part of the inductive process, and it's the last step I'm asking you to do there for content, is I want you to think, how is this oracle part of the Bible's intertextual commentary? How does this text contribute to the unity of the Bible? That's what I'm asking. And it's answered in two respects. First, by asking, how is the oracle rooted in past revelation? The term that is used for that is called informing theology. What are the concepts rooted in Israel's past? Whether it's in the narrative history of Israel's past or other prophets that are being incorporated into this prophet's work that shows the connections of this oracle with so many things that God's got going on. One of my favorite passages of Scripture is Jeremiah chapter 23. And I want you to turn to Jeremiah 23 with me because I want to illustrate this principle of informing theology to you. This is awesome. He says, this is Jeremiah 23 starting in verse 1. Woe to the shepherds who are destroying and scattering the sheep of my pasture, declares the Lord. Therefore, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, concerning the shepherds who are attending my people, you have scattered my flock and driven them away and have not attended to them. Behold, I am about to attend to you for evil for your deeds, declares the Lord. Then, what does that mean? Time change, later, then I myself will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries that I have driven them and bring them back to their pastures, and they will be fruitful and multiply, and I will raise up shepherds over them, and they will tend to them, and they will not be afraid any longer, nor be terrified, nor will any be missing, declares the Lord. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land, and in his day, Judah will be saved, Israel will dwell securely, and this is the name that he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when they will no longer say, as the Lord lives, who brought the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives, who brought up and led back the descendants of the household of Israel from the northland and from all the countries where I have driven them, then they will live on their own soil. Okay, now I just want us to pause. I want to think about this oracle from the standpoint of the allusions, the direct citations, the theological concepts that are borrowed
from texts prior to the writing of Jeremiah. In other words, what are the dimensions of literary dependency that Jeremiah exhibits in this oracle? Do you follow? I'm asking, when we read through, let's look, for instance, here's an easy one, starting in verse 3. Then I myself will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries where I have driven them and bring them back to their pasture, and they will be fruitful and multiply. They will be fruitful and multiply. What does that mean? Where have we seen that before? That's right out of Genesis. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Get out your concordance and cue in on your Bible, whatever it is, .com, gateway.com. The phrase, fruitful and multiply, push enter and cha-ching, 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 cha-ching. And you see a whole list of verses that use this formula, starting in Genesis 1, repeated again in Genesis 9, after the flood, the creation blessing again comes there in the patriarchal narratives, in Exodus, and then boom, right here. And what does it mean? It means that it is the intent of God. It has always been the intent of God that His people be the object of His blessing. And so there's just a richness and a vividness that Jeremiah, in this oracle, is reaching all the way back to the beginning of human history to say that what's happening in his oracle, what he's describing here, is just one more instance of God satisfying this blessing among men to be fruitful and to multiply. God's purposes haven't changed, and here they are once again in this context. You see what I'm saying? So that adds such depth and texture to our reading of this passage to make those connections. Then he says, verse 5, how about, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch. Okay, what's significant there? There's more than one thing going on there. What's he saying? Behold what? Days are coming. Where have we heard that before? That's the standard language of all the prophets. This is the day of the Lord, right? And what happens in the day of the Lord according to this verse? What is God doing? Raising up for David a righteous branch. What's the righteous branch? That's the Messiah. Exactly. So now he's touching base with his compadre Isaiah, who's using this language. And now Jeremiah is using it as well. And he's seeing in his prophecy the fulfillment of God's promise of bringing his messianic rule through David onto the earth. And then he says in verse 7, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when they will no longer say, as the Lord lives, who brought up the sons of Israel from the land of Egypt. But as the Lord lives, who brought up and led back the descendants of the household of Egypt from the north and from all the countries where I've driven them. What's this allusion to? This is the Exodus. So you see all these streams coming together in this incredibly vital river of revelation here, all of these images, all of these things coming together in this oracle of blessing for the resettlement, and all of this language of God saying, you know, here is a time of creation blessing. Here's a time of redemption blessing. Here's a time of Davidic blessing where my rule will come through the Messianic king. And so looking again from the standpoint of multiple reference, you see elements of this that are clearly relating to the resettling of Israel back in the land, but there are also global dimensions of it. This mention of the reign of the branch. So you got all that kind of stuff going on. And this is a super complex, very rich oracle, the content of which is just, it is one of these great intersections theologically in the Bible. And in the prophets, and the prophets are so good at just bringing the whole thought world of the scriptures together into these incredible descriptions. Does this make sense to you? Are you with me? Oh man, this is just vital. So awesome. So these are the kinds of observations then that show us inductively the unity of the biblical story. And then, so in seeing how a prophet uses informing theology, which they all do, then we also want to, you know, raise this question then, how is this text cited or alluded to in other parts of Scripture? How may these citations bear on its meaning, for instance? Well, so here's an interesting one, because this is bringing together the Exodus motif, it's bringing together the Davidic branch, it's bringing together the creation blessing of being fruitful and multiplying. We can see that same sort of thought being carried on, for instance, in Zechariah, much later, at the very end of Old Testament history. And now, you know, Zechariah is viewing Messiah as the branch and so forth, and just it fits into this rich fabric looking forward just as it does looking backward. So that is how we want to characterize and describe then this whole discussion of intertextual commentary.